Building an empire takes skill, dedication, and lots of money. It takes loyal henchmen and financial partners who either share your vision of your empire, or if you at least can create a mutual beneficial business arrangement with them. Since the Second World War, we often talk of the technology of war, the amazing building projects, tanks, planes, the battles, the human sacrifice. We speak of those people in charge of the war. But we never lift the curtain and look closely at who made this possible. Who funded Hitler and why? How did Hitler fund his election campaigns? Who made this possible? How did Germany fund the war and its regime in general? Who continued to do business with the Nazi Reich during the war? Where did the funds, the gold, come from? And where did it all go? And who were, and still are, the sinister international organizations that were supporting Hitler's movement? I understand why. It's a delicate question, because all of those who did business with Hitler's Reich are still in business today. And most of them did not stop simply because the war began. And certainly most were rescued after the war ended. In an industrial collaboration between bankers, national socialists, businessmen, in a configuration that seemingly still exists today. Repainted in new propaganda slogans, yet still run with parts out of Switzerland and through the same intelligence agencies and the descendants of the same people. We speak much of the Nazi gold, the artworks, the large industries, bank names, such as the Bank of International Settlement, Alan Dulles, Schacht, the OSS, Sullivan and Cromwell, and I thought it time for me to break down what really happened, who were these entities, who traded with the enemy, and where did it all go after. Here I will try to break it all down, and from this you can draw your own conclusions and parallels to the dangers facing the world today. At the end of World War I, Germany was deemed to owe reparations to the Allies to the tune of 132 billion gold marks. This Germany could not repay. The French and Belgian armies occupied key industrial areas of Germany, and only by loans from the Americans through the 1924 Dawes Plan kept the German mark from crashing. The US government put a moratorium on repayments of war reparations and made a $200 million loan to German industries for reconstruction. This made it possible for American industry through loans to finance German industry. Between 1931 and 1939, international banks provided Germany with 27 billion marks in loans. 19.1 of these went to pay off the Allies as reparation payments. In order to sort through all these financial transactions, in 1930, the Bank of International Settlements was established. It was, of course, seated in Switzerland and staffed by members of all the warring nations to supervise the transactions. Two key players in this were two corporate lawyers who oversaw the flow of money from America to Germany, John and Alan Dulles. They both worked for the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, a name that will also keep coming up in future history until today. They especially acted on behalf of American companies and industries who wanted to partner up with established German companies or invest in these. During World War I, Alan Dulles had been a State Department attaché to Berlin and Switzerland during the war. Both brothers had been part of the U.S. Commission for the Paris Accords, leading to the signing of the Versailles Peace Treaty, one neither of them favored, given the harsh terms placed on Germany. And inevitably, it did lead to World War II, as was clearly on the mind of many smart people at the time. And a note must be made that the U.S. Congress never ratified the treaty. However, from 1920s, many American companies partnered with German companies, such as Alcoa, DuPont, IBM, GM, ITT, Ford, GE, and a lot more joint enterprises were established. And many German companies merged with the U.S. industries, and in time began to take over control or ownership of many of these companies, such as IG Farben, that through mergers and collaborations became the largest chemical company in the world, a world leader in chemicals, dyes, pharmaceuticals, explosives, and synthetic rubber, amongst a few. In 1929, IG Farben teamed up with Standard Oil to create a process to convert coal into synthetic oil. Through this deal, American money funded the German research in Germany, and in return, IG Farben would share their new Buna process, the production of synthetic rubber, a very important strategic component. Through this, America now had serious stakes in German industrial well-being, and German companies had begun to spread their subsidiaries abroad as well. Germany had all her colonies taken away after World War I. But in this manner, Germany still then had representatives and even German settlements in many countries abroad, along with the now German affiliate banks and political connections that comes with these industries. Obviously, Argentina comes to mind. But there are many other countries, especially neutral countries, included. The stock market crash in 1929 changed many things. One was it finally brought to light how weak the new Weimar government was, and Germany now plunged into inflation, and fights for power began, as is customary in a depression. Germany, as much as the rest of the world, was being fractioned by nationalists and communists. Not much different than today, really. But fighting in the streets became normal. Communists tried to overthrow the governments or seize power in various regions. The military had to be called in. Communist agitators arranged for strikes in factories several times the country over. This is not good for business or private industry, as communism never is. This becomes important. These factions were actively fighting for power in the streets of Germany. It was through this division, the National Socialist Party, the NSDAP, or Nazi Party as we know of it today, slowly emerged and promised to be a bulwark against communism, a danger many Western leaders, bankers, and businessmen had also recognized. And now that the West, especially America, had invested heavily in Germany, nobody wanted communism to overthrow the frail democratic state of Germany. There were indeed among the leaders in the West a great fear of the spread of communism. Now one man, with his party, Adolf Hitler, stood out as a prospect to halt the dangers at the German eastern border. He had taken over leadership of the small NSDAP party in the early 1920s, and had inspired his followers to attempt a push for power in 1923. This failed due to intervention by the military. However, the cause of the German nationalism, as opposed to the Soviet communism, appealed to many in both Germany and abroad. And given the average sentiments of the time of anti-Semitism, the anti-Semitic messages embraced by the National Socialists did not appear as a problem. These were sentiments shared by most Western American leaders at the time also. And the Russians too had anti-Jewish programs, and both after and before both wars. Thus, this was not seen as an indicator of what was to come, not even by German Jews themselves. Thus, Hitler was given a low sentence with significantly added to his popularity, and he and a small circle of old fighters wrote his book Mein Kampf in prison. It is generally appreciated today by many historians that he did not write much of the book himself, but he stood by its messages, and he certainly took in royalties from the sales. After his release until the end of the Second World War, he had earned over 700 million Reichmarks on the sales of the book alone. At the time of his release, a new Mercedes sports car awaited him, as did a long list of financial supporters, bankers, industrialists. It seemed amongst the upper circle in industry that Hitler had been chosen as the man for them to put their support behind. And it is certain that Hitler, in return for their support, promised lucrative government contracts after he came to power. Not much different from how business and politics is done today. Even several Jewish-owned banks in Berlin were initially amongst his supporters. Heavy hitters also entered Hitler's circle of friends, as they were referred to. Siemens, IG Farben, Thyssen, Krupp, and many more. Also Heinrich Himmler, who was slowly building up the SS to be the elite organization of the future in Germany. He too had his circle of friends through which he took donations, however never for himself. He lived a frugal life, and donations raised were for the SS, pensions, health care, and for the organization's growth. He was creating a future where the SS would rival the Reich itself and could promise its own contracts to industry and businesses in exchange for their donations. And the SS image appealed to many of the young aristocrats, both in Germany but also abroad. There was a growing international support by international royalty for the National Socialist movement and for the SS, and many thus joined. This saw Himmler and Hitler's influence and contacts grow further internationally, both with businesses and within royal circles. Hermann Göring would, through his position, also enjoy a similar circle of business friends and their donations. However, unlike the incorruptible Himmler, Göring kept and spent the money he received, directly handed over by large numbers of contracts in exchange for large government contracts, which he could issue given his position in the Reich from 1933, after Hitler was elected. Hitler, having run the first truly modern campaign, flying all over Germany, speaking in several places each day, flyers, posters, election propaganda, arranged by propaganda minister and Gauleiter of Berlin, Joseph Goebbels, with the SA and SS to keep the rallies safe. And already smaller business contracts had begun to be awarded, uniforms, supplies, materials, cars, etc. But nothing is free. Hitler enjoyed support, and especially financial support, from leading German, British, French, and certainly American industrialists and bankers, men who had actively had a financial interest in rebuilding and strengthening Germany to make money and internationalize their industries, and for Hitler to rebuild Germany's military to keep the communist Russians out of the rest of Europe. In 1933, at this same time, Alan Dulles and his brother were in Berlin on behalf of the companies IG Farben and Bosch and United Steelworks. It was run by the German industrialist Fritz Thyssen, a significant early financial supporter of Hitler. Thus, in 1933, the Dulles brothers met with Hitler the first time to discuss business prospects under his new government. And it was Hitler, bent on rearmament, the financial gain for the businesses was obvious. The same month, Dulles brothers also met with Martin Bormann, introduced by Fritz Thyssen. Bormann would eventually run all Hitler's private finances and became the actual gatekeeper to Hitler during especially the end of the war years. This also meant that information intended for Hitler, and it had in later years become clear that Hitler many times acted on wrongful information or was not informed of many smaller and some larger pieces of information throughout the war due to Bormann's interference. Now Bormann, too, had his circle of financial friends that would become extremely important toward the ends of the war and after. He would be making significant economic financial decisions on his own, on behalf of the party, and on Hitler's. Bormann made a better impression on Alan Dulles than he had expected, but it was obvious that he was ruthlessly eyeing the ladder of power by staying close to Hitler. Hitler was inspired by Roosevelt's New Deal, whereby, through presidential decrees, he had ordered many great public works projects in order to start the economy again, in a country still reeling from the Great Depression. Now Hitler did the same, ordered great construction projects, such as the Autobahn, obviously with one eye on military transportation, to complement the railroads, which had played such a large part during the Franco-Prussian War and World War I. Henry Ford imported thousands of parts and components for cars and trucks to Germany, during this time actively until 1938, where he also constructed new Ford factories in Germany. These would be valuable for German industry and military, especially during the war. Ford was now seeing a revenue growth by 400%. In fact, the German Ford Werke AG was recognized as a German company in Germany. Yet Ford in Germany could not keep up with the demand, especially for the military, now leading up to the Czech crisis. So Henry Ford expedited trucks in easy assembly kits from adjacent European Ford plants. GM also acquired German automaker Opel in 1935, whom now produced 100,000 cars per year, including the Opel Blitz truck, the most important German army transportation during the war. Throughout the war, the Opel plants would produce Junkers airplanes and torpedo detonators as well. The Dutch Shell Oil Company was extensively involved in oil refining in Germany. British Dunlop was invested in German rubber, an ethyl gasoline company owned by GM, and Standard Oil developed an important oil additive that would increase the octane of aviation fuel. IG Farben and Ethyl made a strategic partnership to produce this in Germany under the IG Ethyl GmbH in 1935. To the protests of the American War Department, who were slowly waking up to the possibilities of a new war. But they were ignored. This would be extremely important for the Luftwaffe in years to come. IG Farben also bought Swedish Bofors, who made some of the best AA guns of the war, although selling them to both warring sides, so trading with the enemy was not just a one-sided affair. A subsidiary to GM built airframes for the Luftwaffe, made by metals made by Alcoa, for airplanes with electronics built by ITT, flying on fuels built in the factory founded by Standard Oil. In 1940, during the Battle of Britain, over 300 American companies continued doing business with Germany unchanged. This did not stop in December 1941, just because war was declared between US and Germany either. 171 U.S. businesses still had far over $420 million invested in German industry. This was, to some degree, hindered in 1942, with the Trading with the Enemy Act was passed. Hindered, but not stopped. Too much money was being made trading strategic materials. And at this time, these pre-war industrial cartels were now far more powerful than most governments. And these industries were now globally intermingled to an extent where it became almost impossible to untangle them. Not much of this has changed until today, really. In 1942, Alan Dulles left for Bern to officially serve as the Special Assistant for Legal Affairs. In reality, he worked as head of intelligence for the OSS in Europe. At the start of the war, the US had no central intelligence network reporting to the president. What there had been was dismantled in 1928 by Henry Stinson, Secretary of State, citing that gentlemen does not read each other's mail. And what existed was full of inter-service rivalries, and the Navy and Army intelligence would not share intelligence with each other or even work on the same days in the same office. The British intelligence had not much confidence in Dulles' reporting, and collaborations between the services were at a painful start. However, OSS Chief William Donovan had established the OSS in 1942 especially to remedy all of this. The OSS heavily recruited amongst the elite families and law firms, similar to the CIA today, such as from Sullivan and Cromwell Law Firm, including, of course, Alan Dulles. Including also several left-leaning members had joined the OSS. The OSS would, in 1947, morph into the CIA, and Dulles would eventually become its director. One must, however, speculate in 1942 about Dulles' motivations. Certainly he was not a great fan of the British, but as an international corporate lawyer in business with industries inside Germany representing their interests just a year before, associated with a law firm still representing these. However, Dulles did obtain valuable information through new and old contacts. And him having a seat on the board of the Bank of International Settlements that still met throughout the war every month in Bern, where members of all warring nations would meet and continue to do business. After all, war is war and business is business. It must be asked if the ending of the war really was paramount to these industries or banks involved continuing to make money on it. In January 1943, Himmler had sent Prince Maximilian Ergon zu Hohenlohe-Langburg to meet with Dulles to hear him out with a proposal for the SS to remove Hitler if Western powers and Germany could then join forces against the Russians, or at least allow Germany to continue a one-front war against Russia unhindered. Dulles also had contact with several other SS aristocrats, including Ribbentrop's adjutant, and he had channeled to William Canaris, the admiral head in charge of German army intelligence. So connections were made and fostered. But this is not unusual. Backdoor contacts have and is always maintained between the intelligence services of warring nations, or Cold War nations as it was to be seen. These can play significant parts during crisis especially. The Cuban Missile Crisis comes to mind, where nuclear war was averted through backdoor communications between Khrushchev and Kennedy. One significant obstacle to the intelligence bridges being built between the services during the war, the Allied and German ones that is, was Roosevelt's demand for unconditional surrender. And he demanded dismantlement of German industry as well. Both he and Churchill were seeking Stalin's acceptance to execute at least 50,000 top German military and government officials upon recognition and without trial, and also the complete dismemberment of Germany and its industries to be turned into farmland. This was opposed desperately by the American military, as it would clearly make the Germans fight to the bitter end, as there was no reason or hope for an honorable surrender, and for Dulles it took away much of his negotiation tools. And given the financial interest he also represented, it could not be in his nor his client's interest to destroy German industry after the war. In fact, when this was made public, the Germans did fight harder and longer than they would have when they were hoping for a chance of a semi-honorable peace. And it was only due to Stalin's insistence that the Nuremberg trials were actually established under Supreme Court Judge Jackson. As it was agreed between Stalin and Churchill, they can have a trial before they are shot, referring to the Germans. But Jackson was an honorable and somewhat idealistic man, who fought hard for a proper trial and actual justice. However, he was surrounded by politicians merely wanting to shoot the Germans, the SS, Gestapo officers, upon recognition, with no implementation of law, and favored enslavement of the German people regardless of status or affiliation. Also, a rift between Dulles and FDR began due to the Allied stance and constant appeasement of Stalin by FDR and Churchill. But back to the money. This also made it of supreme interest for those industrialists in the Reich, who were in the know, to make arrangements for a post-war Germany and its rebuilding and industry. It must be understood that the Reich was, as most dictatorial regimes, marred by infighting and individual empire building, dual appointments and overlapping areas of responsibility. Goering had quickly become extremely rich upon his appointments and head of the four-year plan which he oversaw, construction of many industries besides the Luftwaffe. But the intriguing between Speer, Bormann, Goering, Himmler, the party itself, the army, the Luftwaffe, the Kriegsmarine, all fighting for resources now dwindling as the war was turning. This convoluted way Hitler had set up in the way of managing his organization made it impossible for one entity or person to cut through the bureaucracy and get anything done. Besides massive corruption and self-enrichment, of course, this also saw individuals seeing past Hitler to their own survival or the survival of their organizations to begin making plans for expatriating assets, gold, patents abroad for a post-war world. Bormann eventually arranged for Operation Feuerland, for just the purpose of evacuating funds, gold assets, patent, and industry out of Germany and German ownership temporarily, planning for the survival of the organization and rebuild a new Germany after the war, but generally with the same players. Several things happened as the National Socialists came to power. One was the slow process of Jews being forced out of German society, increasing pressure to emigrate, having businesses confiscated, or forced to sell these below value. Many tried to emigrate, but many surrounding countries refused to allow them entry to cross their borders even. It was the Swiss who insisted the Jews had the J stamped in their passport, and still refused many entry. Those who were allowed in were placed in labor camps there. Now, by this action, it also meant that 80% of German Jewish art collections were confiscated, and also due to the new cultural insistence that art on display was Germanized, and decadent artworks were confiscated by the state, all years before the war. This thus represented a significant value if sold abroad. And of course, the gold, silver, and other tangible assets were confiscated from the Jews as they were evacuated or expatriated, forced to sell their businesses far below value, as they no longer allowed to own them. This enabled many lower-level businessmen to enrich themselves by obtaining these businesses and industries as well. Or, as some of them were nationalized, organizations such as the Gustloff Stiftung was established especially to manage these seized businesses, and of course, with its Swiss bank accounts in order to do foreign business. Also, the Kaiser Wilhelm's Institute, studies of genetic anthropology and eugenics were carried out, and as we now know later, nuclear research also took place here. Much of this was initially funded by the Rockefeller Foundation from the U.S. Alfred Rosenberg was put in charge of confiscating un-German art. Over 16,000 paintings were confiscated in Germany alone. No compensation was extended to museums or collectors for this, of course. Now, all of this art was stored in a warehouse in Berlin. Initially, Goering sold some of these paintings abroad to simply purchase more for himself. But with the annexation of Austria, thousands more paintings and works of art was confiscated, including all of these belonging to the Rothschilds. Also, the sale of German-owned art displayed abroad could be and was sold in 1939. As we know and see today, art is not really for enjoying. It is an investment and represents significant value. Bormann knew this too. And soon the sales of art abroad began to fund the Reichsbank's vaults and the Swiss bank accounts as well. In 1940, with the conquest of France, Belgium, and Holland, this opened the doors to thousands more pieces of art, paintings, gold, and diamonds. With that, Alfred Rosenberg began to sort through the art in the occupied territories, as personally directed by Hitler to search all collections of art. And the approved art was to be transported to Germany for safekeeping. Of course, there was also the cataloging of non-approved art. These could be used to trade for what was approved. The French authorities had no problem assisting in confiscating private Jewish bank vaults or art collections. This also extended to simple furniture and clothing, as during the war, most German factories were busy making war materials. These were to be logged and collected and transported to the Reich. 17 million cubic feet of materials and furnitures were collected in 1940 alone. And in 1944, 69,500 Jewish homes had been emptied. It took 674 trains with 26,900 freight cars to transport all this furniture back to the Reich. Similar occurred in occupied Russia and Poland. Bormann had all information about exactly where all of this art was stored, and he arranged for much of it, the so-called degenerative art, to be sold through Switzerland in order to buy war materials. However, after Vichy France was occupied and travel for international arts experts could no longer cross these borders into Switzerland, Bormann set up art dealers and sold the art in Buenos Aires or Mexico City. Much of this made its way to the U.S. market, from where the funds were then deposited in Bormann's bank in Argentina, Banco Alemán Transatlántico, through which both Argentine and Spanish shipping companies were used, some owned by German fronts. These funds were also used to purchase critical war material. This trade continued until Paris was nearly taken by the Allies, containing over 22,000 objects from France alone. This was an industrial-scale looting that funded key materials for Germany during the war. But not only that, it also set up Bormann's post-war accounts for the survival of Reich interests with considerable assets. Of course, gold vaults and bank accounts were outright seized from Jews and conquered countries. And the art trade with the Reich and occupied countries continued. Goering, for all his personal flaws, never did want the war. He had tried, both with regards to Czechoslovakia and Poland, through his back channels to make peace deals or hinder the war, but Hitler had overruled him. Goering continued his peace talks through back channels with Britain until 1942. Now, disillusioned, he had taken to his art interest and spent more time shopping in Amsterdam or France than he was at his office. He would pay for the art he acquired, though, although at times at a very reduced rate. Hitler, too, would pay for his art through the account set up in Switzerland for the significant royalties of the sales of his book, and copywriting images such as those on the Reich postal stamps. At the end of the war, Hitler was one of the richest people in Europe from these sales alone. And thousands of Jews held patents in Germany and Austria. These were simply seized and represented millions of dollars worth as well. And of course in Belgium and Germany, seized $11 million worth of diamonds and deposited these in Switzerland and banks in Spain. As the war began in 1939, Germany only had 100 tons of gold in its reserve. Yet at the war's end, Germany had sold over 775 million tons of gold during the war, all sold or traded to the neutral countries, traded in return for services, machinery, bomb detonators, fuel additives, and war material bought from neutral countries around the world or directly purchased from Swiss factories, which also made flamethrowers for the German army. As the world's financial center, neutral Switzerland was perfect. And here Germany could convert gold to Swiss francs and, through straw companies, purchase goods from around the world. Gold went from Norway, France, from everywhere it went to Switzerland, where it also, the Allies, traded their gold. About $400 million worth of gold went to Switzerland. That we know of. There are certainly more secret accounts that still remain unknown. Remember, many of these industrialists also had positions or ownerships of banks, some of which were in the U.S. Hjalmar Schacht, director of the Reich Bank from 1933, before the war had set up numerous secret accounts for gold trading towards rearmament. In 1934, Germany held $80.5 million worth of gold, while the secret accounts held $27 million. By 1939, this had reversed and more gold had been added. By now, the hidden accounts held $83 million, while the official accounts held $27 million worth. And towards the end of the war, Germany had purchased foreign materials for $890 million worth paid in gold. Until the outbreak of war, most foreign countries and banks would accept the Reichsmark gladly. However, after the outbreak of war, these demanded foreign currency or gold. In 1937, the Austrian Central Bank held 200,000 pounds of gold worth over $100 million. In 1938, the Czech Bank held $44 million worth, Holland $163 million, Belgium $202 million worth. In Italy, in 1943, $80 million worth of gold. Yugoslavian gold was shared between Germany and Italy initially, with some set up for pro-Axis governments there. Poland's gold was by the director of the Bank of Poland personally escorted overseas through Turkey to France and from there to Dakar, where also the remaining French and Belgian gold was now stored. The Belgian gold was eventually handed back over to the Germans, returned by the French in 1942, but not the Polish, which eventually made its way to New York. These tons of gold made their way to the Reich Bank, and, if it was necessary to re-smelt the captured gold, it was done in the Prussian state mint, into new bars, and stamped with pre-war markings, barring their identifications or origins. The firm Degussa, partnered with IG Farben, was in charge of smelting the gold taken from prisoners at the camps, and had even its own smelting company set up at Auschwitz. From August 1942 until the end of the war, 78 shipments of gold arrived to the Reich Bank, with dental and other gold from those who had died in the various camps. This gold was deposited in a special SS account, an SS officer in charge of these gold transport named Melner. From there, funds were transferred to an account controlled by Ernst Kaltenbrunner, head of the Reich Main Security Office. Through this account, the SS made various international investments through the International Bank of Settlement also. In 1942, Bormann became aware of these gold shipments and insisted for 20% for himself, which went to his Reich account. And I would find it impossible if not significant amounts of gold, jewelry, and valuables were not sidelined by soldiers, local commanders, or SS men for their personal stash. Himmler would prosecute any corruption amongst his men harshly. So knowing this, it is entirely possible that those who could would hide what they had taken. Some drove it to Switzerland and opened numbered accounts themselves. Small units or individual soldiers would bury treasure by the end of the war or before their surrender. These stashes are still hidden out there, as many of them never returned to claim them. How much gold was taken, found, or hidden is purely a matter of speculation. But the organized gold transfers from the occupied territories, the need for this in order to facilitate the war industry, is the one clear indication that there could never be a last-minute end-of-the-war gold train full of gold. Any large amount would have been seized and transported to Berlin and from there to Zurich, or traded as it was found. The same can be said for the still-missing artworks. From Bucharest, tons of gold, 3 shipments in 1 week alone from Romania went to Zurich, millions of Reichmarks in gold from January 1943 to 1945 went straight to the Reich Bank. This is a clear indication that gold seized in the occupied countries would be transferred immediately, long before the Russians closed in on it. Not only due to the security of the gold, but also as it was simply needed and used to pay for war materials and industry. Now, of course, Germany would need several methods of making gold payments to foreign companies, and the Swiss were quick to see the financial opportunity of facilitating this. Already in 1934, they had established the method of numbered bank accounts to ensure secrecy of the account owners. This also to aid those Jews who wanted to hide their assets from the Nazi regime. In 1939 alone, before the somewhat expected German invasion of Poland, over 17,000 deposits in Swiss accounts were made by Polish Jews, who had been issued Swiss-numbered accounts. Thus, only the real owner of these accounts was privy to the account with the correct information. And in the banks themselves, only very few officials had access to the real owner's identity. This, of course, led to a long-drawn-out legal battle against the Swiss banks after the war, for the survivors or their families of those account holders. In the decades after the war, this became a larger issue, as those survivors of the war relative to those who died now began to attempt to access their money. The case only truly broke after one of the employees at one bank discovered that the bank was shredding information about these accounts and turned this into the proper authorities. For half of their international trade during the war, the German Reich favored working through the Bank of International Settlements. This bank was also, by charter, immune to prosecution or seizure. This was where the central bankers from around the world met and did business. And they continued to meet every month throughout the war. The two principal officers of the bank were Hjalmar Schacht and Sir Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, old friends. In fact, Sir Norman was the godfather of one of Schacht's children. Thomas McKittrick, the New York banker and an established Nazi sympathizer, was the chairman until 1946. Author Walther Funk, the president of the Reich Bank from 1939, was on the board, as was the chairman of IG Farben. And notably on the board was SS General Kurt von Schröder, Hitler's personal banker and owner of the J.H. Stein Bank of Cologne, whose most noted client was the SS. Ernst Kaltenbrunner was on the Stein Bank board as well. Von Schröder was also the director of 30 other companies in Germany, including ITT Germany. He was, of course, affiliated with the J.H. Schröder & Company Bank of London, the German government's primary financial agent in Britain from 1938. And in turn, they owned J.H. Schröder Banking Incorporation in New York, whom went into partnership with J. Rockefeller in 1936 to become the Schröder Rockefeller Bank, and the director of this was none other than Alan Dulles. Welcome to the fraternity of international banking. Until 1939, the Bank of International Settlements funneled 290 million Swiss francs into Germany and continued to assist Germany throughout the war. In 1938, after all of Czechoslovakia had been annexed by the Germans, it held 27 million in gold in the Bank of International Settlement account in the Bank of England. Germany demanded this handed over, and Sir Norman signed it over to his friend Helmut Schacht. He had the gold released to Germany through the Bank of International Settlements. But it was the need for raw materials that primarily fueled the money laundering operation, such as for Swedish iron ore, Turkish chromium, Malayan rubber, wolfram from Portugal and Spain, especially needed for armor-piercing projectiles. Everybody brought wolfram and other materials from Portugal. The Allies paid in dollars or pounds, and Germany paid for it in gold. At the outset of the war, Portugal's National Bank held 63 tons of gold. In 1945, it held 365 tons of gold. Also, with neutral Spain did Germany trade for goods and raw materials, all paid for in gold. Spain was a special concern for the Allies, given the pre-war assistance Germany had lent Franco during the Civil War fighting against Spanish communists. Now, Franco did not have any intentions of actually joining the war actively against Russia, as Hitler had hoped for, much to the intervention of Wilhelm Canaris. But certainly there was quiet alliance, continued constant trade between the two countries. German radio transmitters and agents worked in Spain. Also, German submarines were fueled from the Canary Islands. However, the Allies hoped to keep Spain from actively joining the war on the German side and kept shipping materials and foodstuffs to Spain, citing the need for Spain to remain neutral, which she did, while Franco managed to pay off the Spanish national debt and tripling his gold reserves during the war. The same went for the Swedish iron ore, desperately needed for the German military industry. This was the main reason for the invasion of Denmark and Norway, to keep the trade routes clear and keep Britain from invading Norway, as Britain had planned. In fact, the British had made plans to invade Norway and Sweden, a neutral country, to seize the iron ore mines themselves. And Germany only beat them to Norway by one day. Also, Sweden manufactured 40% of the 100 million ball bearings Germany needed every year. The remainder was produced by Swedish subsidiaries, such as the factory in Schweinfurt, Germany, or in Switzerland. Noting the Allied bombing of the Swiss ball bearing factory in Schaffhausen, against Allied bombing a neutral country, they did claim it was an accident, of course. But knowing the Swiss were actively trading with Germany, one must wonder if it was not a hint from the US Air Force for them to reconsider. They did not. All the ball bearings, too, were paid for in looted gold or in Swiss francs. The gold was initially deposited by Germany in Swiss banks, and after taking their commission, the banks would make the transfers to the various companies owed for the war material, thus sent to Germany. These gold transfers through Swiss banks began to become troublesome towards the end of the war, as it became clear that Germany would lose the war. The Allies' pressure on the Swiss increased, but was generally ignored. Still, a gold deposit system and cash transfer system was set up through which the Reich bought currency for the gold. Throughout the war, at least 388 tons was processed through the Swiss national banks, and 378 tons through the Bank of International Settlements. Of course, these were for financing of the war. Many Nazi officials and organizations deposited millions of dollars, gold, outworks, in other accounts, with smaller banks also involved. Remember the huge SS bank account SS General Kammler had at his disposal at the end of the war. One of the many reports on this are released to the National Archives, and it was suggested the topic of the general's interrogation in June 1945 in Ebensee, in relation to the financial structure of the cement tunnels and factories there, all hidden in numbered accounts and hidden by the Swiss banking laws of secrecy enacted in 1934. As the war was beginning to turn against Germany after the Battle of Kursk, people such as Martin Bormann and Heinrich Himmler had also begun to make active plans for what was coming. Bormann was an extremely cunning person, and he had himself organized the sale of art in Switzerland, although many of the paintings were sold at a low price. In 1939, the first 500,000 Swiss francs was converted into British pounds and deposited in British banks. Then in 1940, 940,000 uncut diamonds were seized in Amsterdam, and 290,000 diamonds in Belgium. High-value, low-volume items were easy to trade with, pay people off with, bribes, etc. Bormann had also obtained his own shipping line by 1943, through a Spanish cutout under Spanish flag. And he had also obtained an Italian airline company specializing in flights to South America. Through these, Bormann could discreetly maneuver people and riches to South America without using Luftwaffe or Kriegsmarine assets, banks, and thus in secrecy. These airlines would make regular flights carrying assets, valuables, and people to German embassies and organizations as Bormann would set up his post-war empire in return for strategic materials needed for the war effort. It was also through this effort that counterfeit British banknotes were made for the foreign embassies in order to purchase materials or for bribes. Most of these printed were smaller denomination bills, 5, 10s, 20s, 50-pound notes, as to not attract too much attention. The forgeries of British notes began in 1942 under Operation Bernard, named after the SS Major Bernard Kruger, in direct control. Overall command was Walter Schellenberg, the SS foreign spy chief. The man whom Himmler later had also used to contact Alan Dulles during the war. Operation Bernard printed in total nearly 10% of what was in circulation of all British pound notes, to the tune of 143 million. That's 4.5 billion of today's dollars. These notes were so well made that they were actually laundered successfully through Swiss bank accounts as well. These forged notes were used to pay the informer who told the SS where Mussolini was being held in 1943 after his capture. Following the post-war planning effort, towards the end of the war, over 200 German companies had set up affiliates in Argentina. Patents, plans, and assets were transferred out of Germany through Swiss shell companies and banks to Argentina, where funds were deposited in German banks as well. These companies also provided jobs for the Germans who had fled Germany after the end of the war. This process was repeated in Portugal, Spain, Sweden, and Turkey as well, and Bormann had obtained large amounts of these local currencies also. But also in North America did Bormann begin to obtain companies, or suggest joint mergers through shell companies. Towards this end, he had consulted with IG Farben, as they had obtained ownership of many American companies before the war. IG held a voting majority of 170 American companies and minority share in a further 108. Its president and Hjalmar Schacht both advised and aided Bormann through the Bank of International Settlements. Leading foreign industrialists were paid £2,300 in gold bullion to make straw purchases of foreign and American companies on behalf of Bormann. The gold was deposited in Swiss accounts. For its help, Bormann made significant investments in the Norwegian hydro plant, making heavy water for the German nuclear scientists. And hydro was now also owned by IG Farben. Through these methods, Bormann was able to obtain 970 foreign companies and 707 of these in neutral countries, with 232 companies in Switzerland and several hundred in Sweden, more in Argentina and Turkey. Thus, the economic foundation for a future post-war Reich was laid. And today many of these companies we may still not know of. It was claimed that it was Hitler himself who had ordered Bormann to hide the assets needed to establish a Fourth Reich. However, this is still speculation. The seat of the new organization was located in South America, as we know. And Colonel Perón in Argentina had been on the German payroll for several years, and certainly he was aided to power by Bormann's financial assets. Also here was a large German community, existed there long before World War II. So now, with political cover, the local infrastructure in place, Bormann could feel quite secure in Argentina. So the Germans, Austrians, and others who quietly trickled into Argentina preceded by gold, diamonds, assets, the money laundering through Argentinian German-owned bank continues until 1947, including several U-boats unloading crates of what was expected to have been gold. Swiss banks, too, had a shared interest in shielding German assets and old Nazi accounts, especially towards the last days of the war, as many Swiss companies had been purchasing German and Austrian companies, transferring ownership that these may also not be confiscated by the Allies, protecting them as much as possible in order to re-establish business as usual as soon as possible after the war had ended. And also after the war, the Bank of International Settlements changed directors to a Swiss national, facilitating an easy cover-up of wartime deeds, and was able to ward off criticism and forced closure. In 1944, August 10th, Bormann invited all German leading industrialists to the Maison Rouge Hotel. This meeting was chaired by Bormann's representatives, Otto Scheidt from the SS. He ordered them all to make liaisons with foreign companies and through establishing overseas companies in neutral companies, and upon order from him to begin transferring assets out of Germany through various banks. Also through Fritz Thyssen's bank in Rotterdam, which was originally funded by Thyssen's father in 1918 in order to facilitate the Kaiser's assets being transferred out of Germany before the end of World War I. Through this bank, money was funneled to Union Bank in New York, owned by Thyssen's United Steelworks. There, the money went to Citibank and Chase National Bank, and used to buy stocks in U.S. corporations. Now all excess capital of German companies left Germany through the Deutsche Bank to Switzerland. The same went for buying gold bonds and stocks now being deposited around the world. 1,618 patents were registered to German banks by 1938. After 1944, there were 3,877. These were transferred out of Germany to other foreign-based patent holders, thus still valid and out of reach of the Allies after the war had been lost. Dr. Kurt Bose from the Reich Armaments Industry emphasized in 1944 to the industrialists that the war would continue until key points had been met in order for the economic German resurgence after the war. He also admitted that after the defeat, some key leaders of the Reich and the Nazi Party would be sacrificed to the Allies, but many of the lesser-known talented personnel would be rescued. One key figure was the chairman of the Deutsche Bank, Hermann Abs, and of course also Hjalmar Schacht, still on the board of the Bank of International Settlements. The chairman of IG Farben, Hermann Schnitzler, was sent to Madrid under the cover story that he was about to be arrested by the Gestapo and had thus fled. He was really there to facilitate the movement of money and assets, aided by two Spanish banks that was in turn owned by Deutsche Bank. Millions and millions of dollars flowed through these two banks through South America. Himmler and Bormann had in 1942 both conversed about the possible German defeat. The two had constantly fought for positions and power, but could easily have seen through this past to the end of the war. But it's quite apparent that Himmler was destined to be sacrificed, as was Goering, as Bormann made sure to have them both removed from power the very last days of the war. And both had marks to their names in all of the Allies' black books, and thus they were a liability. I wonder if Bormann and Kammler had come to an arrangement. And I will stipulate, given the evidence, I personally am now certain that Bormann survived the war and that Himmler was killed by the British in captivity. Whether these are related is hard to say at this point. Throughout the end of the war, the Allies had only encouraged the German people to keep fighting, given their proposed alternative to surrender, and have their country destroyed, Industry dismantled and turned into farmland. Henry Montagu, who hated the Germans, tried to pressure the Swiss to stop trading with the Germans, and the Swiss suggested they would comply. But in reality, two-thirds of Swiss trade was with Germany at this time, so in practice, nothing happened, or could happen. An interesting note, as FDR wanted to prosecute many of the Americans who could be cited for having traded with the enemy. An interesting note on this stance was that many of these were the same Americans who had opposed FDR's New Deal and was his political opponents. However, this was obviously impossible anyway, as this would destroy the U.S. economy, and even involved the OSS and Station Chief Alan Dulles. The breach between Dulles, the military, and the American FDR government broadened due to the disagreement about the fate of post-war Germany. And interestingly to note was it was the German intelligence, the Abwehr, whose agents had intercepted communications between the British and U.S. governments, that Dulles was under investigation by FDR. And the Swiss, who had also been approached by FDR's staff inquiring about Dulles. These had all warned him of what was afoot. Now, Cold War between Dulles and the FDR administration began. One that, from Dulles' intrigues, resulted in FDR having to change his running mate to Harry Truman, a person more sympathetic to Dulles. It was now apparent that Roosevelt's policies was at great odds with most leadership in the military and intelligence, and certainly the industrial interests some of these represented. One might say that it was fortunate for Germany that FDR passed when he did. And Truman, a somewhat more level-headed politician, entered the scene at a time where Supreme Court Justice Jackson was being pegged as the head of the International Crimes Tribunal against the major war criminals after the war. Jackson was an idealist, but he was appalled at the suggestions of FDR, Roosevelt, and Stalin, as discussed at Yalta, of merely shooting top German officers, SS, Gestapo, and politicians out of hand without trial. Also, the Russians expected to deport several million Germans to Russia for slave labor uses, regardless of their political affiliations, women, children, and whomever they wanted. Morgenthau pressured the new president and Jackson to fall in line with which FDR had discussed. The complete dismantling of German heavy industry. Jackson knew this would mean starvation and complete breakdown of Germany, leading to more unrest and future wars. He had allies who understood the rebuilding of Germany was key to Europeans' recovery, and this was on the table before the war ended. Towards the end of the war, Dulles had been negotiating with General Wolfe and Kaltenbrunner and Bormann, but Donovan initially had to shut down the direct contact with Wolfe due to the political pressure. It was clear that many Germans and SS would be interested in surrendering to the Americans. But FDR had always refused these talks and given in further to pressure from Stalin. However, in quiet corners, Donovan allowed Dulles to continue. And as we know, Dulles, throughout his life, always found a way to get things his way. But this time, at odds with the American president, he was not allowed to try to end the war early. This frustrated him clearly, but he kept up the conversations with Himmler and Schellenberg. However, with the announcement of Germany's post-war dismantling and the arrest of all those the Allied deemed as war criminals, including Himmler, it soon became futile to continue. Although one could justify Dulles' intentions in 1942 that doing a deal with Himmler, having him dispose of Hitler, making peace with the West, forcing a post-fact peace with the Russians, could then have been possible. And it also seemed clear that despite the objections of FDR, those Germans with talents needed by the U.S. after the war would be invited back on board. Industrialists and bankers, old friendships were protected or given light sentences and repurposed. German intelligence teamed up with the CIA and the Gestapo changed uniforms back into the police. But those poor souls on the front line, those who did the fighting and dying, well, they paid the ultimate price. Thousands died in prison camps, millions mourned forced resettlements from the former German territories. But it was not just gold that was important now. Before the war, Germany had pioneered nuclear research, and there was a clear industrial-scale production of radioactive materials. with France and Holland taken, tons of uranium in various forms was seized, and hundreds of tons were mined and manufactured in the Reich during the war. Despite post-war claims detracting from German nuclear efforts, a substantial effort was in place in Germany during the war. And towards the end of the war, there was a lot of uranium and uranium ore in Germany, more than was available to the American Manhattan Project, and only after the influx of this captured German uranium could the bomb manufacturing and testing continue on schedule. Something many people fail to understand today, but from parallel research, it is clear that the German nuclear bomb program was farther along than have since been claimed. And there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that several variations of nuclear devices were tested. So where did all of this go after the war? In 1945, parts of the Alsos missions went into the Russian zone of occupation to investigate the bombed-out Oranienburg and Strasfurt, the German uranium manufacturing plants of Auerwerke. These had been especially bombed in order that the Russians would not take them intact. The Cold War was already on the horizon in early 1945. The Alsos teams here went there in order to retrieve especially the uranium claimed to be there before the Russians could. They found 1,100 tons of uranium ore, which was retrieved. Now the Allies, soon after the war, put out the story that the German scientists were nowhere near close to a nuclear bomb or a reactor. But they were only citing Heisenberg and the reactor set up in Hagelock. They never made mention of the serious players for the SS or Diebnus reactor in Stadilm, and possibly other places as well. And after the war, Bormann, or someone high up, made sure to sell the idea of nuclear research and weapons to Perón in Argentina, along with many top German scientists and aviation designers who all went to work in Argentina, such as the Horten brothers, who designed the Horten jet flying wing. But had they also sold the nuclear research and special programs to the Americans? If so, who had facilitated this? It has recently come to light that it is quite possible that along with gold and all the other assets, parts of the SS nuclear program's assets and uranium was transferred to Switzerland proper, from where traces of it vanished like so much else. And we know that the trucks with Kurt Diebner and his research, uranium, and plans for his reactor was last seen leaving Stadilm by Jonastal and was headed south. Was it actually left behind for the Alsos missions here is still unclear, but the transmission captured from the Alsos team to Washington was, upon arriving there, "We struck gold." End quote. The war was coming to an end, and soon the victorious Allies were planning war crimes trials to come, showing a great division between the Allies' intentions, and certainly when it came to trying the industrialists, there was strong opinion against the tangle that might create. Jackson wanted to put the very creation of war on trial. The Southern idealistic lawyer, who ended up as Supreme Court Justice, was probably the best choice to proceed over a court and a trial that had never in history been tried before. The British and French wanted to eradicate all German industry. FDR and Churchill wanted to merely shoot any German officials upon recognition. FDR even spoke on paper of sterilizing Germans whole scale, while negotiating with the Russians on how many millions of German men and women they would kidnap to work as forced laborers for an undetermined time. Jackson was appalled, and fought a bitter struggle with Morgenthau, who hated the Germans. But as the war came to a close, the Russians had already begun to transport German civilians to Russia and shooting anybody as they saw fit. Deeds done, making Jackson uncomfortable sitting on the same bench as them. Still not knowing of the Allies' war crimes. Also, Mussolini had been killed when finally captured, quite possibly on the behest of the British Secret Service. No trial of Italians was thus needed or possible, as those involved had already been dispatched, or as Jackson was told, were currently being dispatched by the Italians themselves. This left the selection of which German leaders to be put on trial, and for what. Quite often, a lot of horse trading amongst the Allied representatives took place before these trials. And finally, the Russians attended in favor of a speedy trial before the accused was hanged. Even the prosecution team of Jackson's was fractured within itself. William Donovan, as head of the OSS, who indeed would be sitting on a lot of important documents, was invited on board by Jackson and claimed to do whatever he could to make himself useful. However, he also tried to pressure Jackson to allow Hjalmar Schacht off by making him testify against others and thereby working himself out of the noose. However, Jackson would not hear of it, as he saw Hjalmar Schacht as one of the key defendants that should be tried for making the war possible by having financed it. The Nuremberg trials should have been the pinnacle crowning work for the victorious Allies, as Jackson hoped it should have been. But faced with the Allies' complete destruction of German cities and deliberate targeting of civilians, and more notes of Allied atrocities clearly began to unnerve him. But he resolved himself to resist and focus on the task in front of him. What he did not know was that the torture of defendants currently undergoing, their relatives, blackmail, and pressure by even members from his own staff, falsifications of evidence, coercing of witnesses, all individual cases for dismissal or mistrial in any Western court today. But these are events that had only been brought to light in the years after. After the trial, however, Jackson himself wrote, I quote, "What happened here had nothing to do with justice," end quote. Indeed, the same Russian envoy that Stalin had sent in order to draw up the trial parameters and whom to pick to be tried also now turned up as the judge himself. The Russians were even able to suppress the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact and their part of the invasion of Poland from the trial itself by having witnesses pressured and threatened. Germans were also put on trial for the Katyn Forest massacre, where 30,000 Polish officers were shot by the Russian NKVD. These are facts we now know, and the Russians have readily admitted it since. Yet Germans were tried for this crime. And the problem this has resulted in is that since laws have been passed based on the Nuremberg trial verdicts, this has left an unfulfilled vacuum of resemblance of law and gave ground to a vast amount of speculations, conspiracies, and misperceptions of the war. Important issues not clearly dealt with to clearly place facts on trial. The German defenders were also only allowed to pull papers for the defense of their clients from the papers allowed them by the prosecutors, not the full gamut of Allied papers obtained. Something completely unheard of in a democratic Western trial. In fact, members of the various Allied prosecution teams were found to actively destroy and burn papers that might add the defendant's defense. Now, the trial outcomes may quite possibly have been the same. However, the information and responsibilities shifted, but extremely important historical and moral lessons could have been learned from these. Quoting Göring having said, "Nobody will ask the victors if they lied." Now, regardless if Bormann or whoever survived the war, the fact remains that afterwards significant German assets had been placed in companies and countries and banks surrounding the country. And it was very soon after the end of the war apparent that Germany needed to be rebuilt. Germany now divided in four sections by the victorious Allies, it was clear that the Russians had no intentions of leaving their eastern part of Germany. Thus, it was now up to the Allies, especially the British and Americans, to start rebuilding Germany, and German industry was of key importance in rebuilding the country, and indeed war-torn Europe. And also, it became quite clear that both what Himmler had said and Dulles and others had feared, they now needed Germany as a bulwark against Russian communism once again. However, they had no intentions of allowing a similar end to Germany's surrender like World War I, whereas soon after, a Germany victorious could rise again and pose a threat to anyone else. But all these assets that had trickled out of Germany could now funnel back in to the Western German Republic. Heavily subsidized and supported by American and foreign investment, West Germany became a powerhouse. So regardless if this was design or sudden need by all, Germany was rebuilt in the way Bormann had intended when funneling all the assets out of Germany to return, which they did over the following decades. and generally rebuilt by the same industries and businesses that had been set up and prepared before the war, and during the war, organized to survive. So what was the aftermath, and what was it to look like? Walter Funk, the president of the Reichsbank during the war, was sentenced to life in prison after the war. He was released in 1957. Hjalmar Schacht, who had fallen out with Hitler over the economic policy in 1939, but had retained a ministerial post and his seat on the board of the Bank of International Settlements. In 1944, he was arrested on suspicions of involvement with the July 20th plotters against Hitler. He was arrested by the Allies in 1945 and put on trial in Nuremberg. He had, however, never been a member of the Nazi Party, and he had, as his defense, tried to help German Jews immigrate out of the country. He was fully acquitted, as expected. The German court tried him afterwards, but here too he was freed on appeal in 1948. He returned to banking and international economics, starting his own bank in 1953, and worked with many foreign countries, and at times as a cutout in interesting arms deals internationally. He died in 1970. Fritz Thyssen, who had, with Hjalmar Schacht, both petitioned the Kaiser in 1933 to appoint Hitler Reichskanzler, seeing him as the strongest opposition against communists. Thyssen, the wealthy industrialist, was an early supporter of the NSDAP and Hitler himself, right up until Kristallnacht. And in 1940, he wrote Göring that he was opposed to the war. However, so was Göring, and neither man was able to stop Hitler going forth with his plans. So Thyssen left Germany for Switzerland, and later for France, where he was arrested and sent back to Germany. His company was nationalized, and he and his wife spent the remainder of the war in somewhat comfortable surroundings and confinement until 1945, where they and other prominent people, like Hjalmar Schacht, were sent to Austria, where they were surrendered to the Americans. Thyssen admitted to having early supported Hitler along with other industrialists and was issued a fine of 500,000 Deutschmarks. He later emigrated to Argentina, where he died in 1951. His family eventually had returned control of their family business. It was apparent that most industrialists was in favor of the cause, but opposed to the methods. Emil Puhl, the director and vice director of the Reichsbank, who was instrumental in looting gold from occupied countries, including that of the concentration camp victims, was sentenced to 4 years in prison and released early. Hermann Schmidt, director of IG Farben, was sentenced to 5 years in prison, released early, whereafter he became head of the Administrators' Council of German Bank and president of Rheinische Stahlwerke AG. IG Farben had originally been the result of the merger of many different industries. After the war and the Nuremberg industrialists' trial, the company was split back into the original forming companies. The IG company itself was ordered to break up, something that IG Farben finally announced it had completed by 2001. The various IG managers who were sentenced to prison in Nuremberg all received early releases. Most were quickly restored to their directorships and other positions in post-war companies, and some were awarded the Federal Cross of Merit. Both Ford and GM sued the Allies after the war for reparations for the loss of the factories they owned in Germany, which had been bombed by the Allied air forces, and were both awarded the compensation. Now that, of course, spurred the forced laborers who had been forced to work for Ford and GM in Germany. They sued the company for damages, as they had not been compensated for being forced to work there. However, this was denied by U.S. courts, citing it was foreign jurisdiction. Baron Kurt von Schröder, Hitler's financier, was sentenced to 3 months in prison. After the war, British and Henning Morgenthal proposed the Bank of International Settlement to be closed. This was opposed by many, including John Maynard Keynes. Still, it was approved, but of course, as we now know, it never happened, and the decision was reverted officially in 1948. And the Bank of International Settlements today still play a key and uncertain part of the direction of world financial affairs. And Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm both Dulles brothers worked for and with, its mainstay was, and still is, ensuring American business interests be imposed on any small country it so wishes. Hired by practically all supranational companies, their names pop up when conversing, both about the Kennedy assassination players and even 9/11. Of course, they represented the big financial institutions after the crash in 2008, and they were even hired recently to represent FTX. You can't make this stuff up, really. But if I ever planned personally on taking over the world, they would be my first call. During the war, they worked extensively for German companies, and after, they worked with both German and Japanese companies to restructure their debt in order to continue their businesses. I wonder if they have a client file on Martin Bormann. In 1953, Alan Dulles became the head of the CIA, and his brother became Secretary of State. Thereby, the two control both the overt and the covert part of all U.S. foreign policy. And within the first 9 months, they had organized a coup in Iran and Guatemala, where the Sullivan and Cromwell represented the United Fruit Company. And if you know, they are not just in the fruit business. And Eisenhower would become president. And afterwards, in his goodbye speech, he strongly warned the world of the military-industrial complex, which we today can be said to include the food producers and big pharma and mass media as well. Sadly, nobody listened. After being fired by Kennedy, Dulles did not appear to stop actively running the CIA. He merely continued from his home in Georgetown. The new Republican director was circumvented in ways, and Dulles and the CIA continued to undermine Kennedy until he was finally murdered in Dallas. Alfred Rosenberg, the man mainly accredited for forming the National Socialist policies and the appropriation of foreign assets, were sentenced to death in 1946. SS Brigadeführer Walter Schellenberg, head of Amt V, Foreign Intelligence Services, who had tried to negotiate peace and release of Jews from concentration camps in late war, he was charged with war crimes. He was, however, generally not seen as a major war criminal, but sentenced to 6 years for having been involved in the death of some Russian POWs. However, testified against other members of the SS, he earned his early release in 1951, where he moved to Switzerland. He died the following year from liver cancer, but wrote a now-published book on his memoirs. Heinrich Himmler, the man who created the SS and the largest police force in the world, who had, through Schellenberg, tried to negotiate peace with Alan Dulles in 1942 by offering to assassinate Hitler, but to continue the war against the Russians. A plan to Dulles' liking, however, FDR and the Washington politicians would not hear of it, busy to appease Stalin. Himmler knew an awful lot about important people and issues around the world, including British royalty, and he sent Churchill a personal letter before the war's end. Churchill destroyed it, and it is by now quite certainly that he ordered Himmler killed once captured by the British after the war. This also included quite a few other high-ranking SS officers who magically suicided themselves upon capture. He simply knew too much, and much like Hess, he was never allowed to tell. Based on circumstantial evidence, but could be proven if Himmler's body was to be found. It is buried in Lüneburg Heath, and only a few people left alive today still knows where. And what of Hitler's personal secretary, Martin Bormann? The man who made it possible for all these millions of German assets, money, gold, patents, to leave the country in order to come back and help rebuild it. Well, his is a different story. Bormann was claimed to have been killed in Berlin in 1945, yet his body was not found until early 1990s. DNA testing done on the body was insufficient and generally meaningless, as by the time, regardless where he had been, if he had lived, he was certain to have expired by the 1990s anyway. The body had traces of red clay around it, the same clay that can be found in South America. Bormann was extremely clever and industrious, and it seems extremely unlikely he would have saved up millions of Reichmarks, francs, dollars, gold, diamonds, art, silver in foreign accounts, knowing that the war was lost, but without an escape plan, other than hoping to ride out of Berlin clinging to a Panzer IV. And given the deliberate, inadequate DNA testing by the German government and the subsequent destruction of the body, it cannot be paired up to the DNA of the children Bormann appears to have fathered after the war. But nearly $1 billion worth of 1944 dollars had been deposited in foreign accounts. Hundreds of German industries had thus been saved, patents and ownerships transferred away from the possibility of them being taken as reparations. Somebody certainly had access to these funds after the war. And the hard line against Germans included the dismantling of heavy industry in the western zones of occupation, ended in 1948, as the Cold War was now apparent. Both the British and Americans reverted back to the similar policies that had originally placed Hitler in power in the first place, namely to rebuild a strong Western Germany as a bulwark against the communist Russians. The industrialists went back in business. The CIA formed, as the West German intelligence formed, now led by Hitler's former head of Eastern Intelligence, Fremdes Heeres Ost, Reinhard Gehlen. He was sponsored by the CIA to spy on the Russians. And, as Adenauer, Germany's first chancellor after the war, was elected, Gehlen was officially named the head of West German intelligence, and within its charter naming the West German interests above those of his American sponsors. And all of the war times, German talented industrialists, their assets, Sullivan and Cromwell, the former Nazi officials, lawyers, former Gestapo officers, policemen, all returned to work for the West German government. And in time, Himmler's vision of a greater Europe, as he outlined it in 1942, of the structure of a greater European financial union, became a reality, led by his personal advisor, Walter Hallstein, as the founding director. In a speech Hallstein later gave, he justified the German seizing of Austria and parts of Czechoslovakia in what Hallstein referred to as the link-up of Austria with Germany and with large parts of what used to be known as Czechoslovakia, as the seizing of these was being part of the creation of the Greater German Reich and the legal Germanization of the new territories. In other words, he was using legal language to claim Germany had a legal right to take these countries and make them part of what he called Greater Germany. He also specifically stated that the failure to create a unified legal system for this Greater Germany was one of the unfinished tasks and failure of the Second German Reich. That the EU was conceptualized and revived all by loyal National Socialists should be a testament to the very nature of such an organization. One clear historic lesson that should have been learned from the communist and Nazi empires are that proportionate with the growth of bureaucracy is reverse proportionate to the reduction of the personal freedoms of the people living under these regimes. Today, people are losing personal freedoms through the slow encroachment of laws, over-regulations of their lifestyles, and policing of their speech and information, even on their social networks. Not by men with guns. They're no longer needed. This is done in a way that would make both Joseph Goebbels, Heinrich Himmler, and Joseph Stalin incredibly envious, with the means of controlling people and their minds, and the self-induced mind control with an ever-growing strength. As we all know, both politicians and journalists are, not now, as if they were living under a dictatorship, moral cowards. Despite knowing better, they fail to make a stand for humanity. And quite in the spirit of the National Socialists who came up with the concept, the EU is today an unelected, non-democratic, top-run centralized bureaucracy dictating how every European must live and slowly taking away any remnants of personal liberties, freedoms, and the pursuit of economic independence, and now threatening to take away the very fuels and foods needed. It is interesting that during the Second World War, Albert Speer had commissioned a report about how agriculture would be able to sustain life if fertilizer was removed or reduced, with the intention of redistributing these assets to war production. It was proved then that it would result in massive starvations, as we see in 1946. Yet today, 76 years after, those in power are ordering crisis reductions of fertilizer, closing of farms and limitations of meat manufacturing, which have no less of an effect on the starving population than it had in 1946. using the best methods of Joseph Goebbels' propaganda and scare tactics, imagine crisis after crisis are distracting us from reality as we see our living standards diminish. That the lessons of the war are not assimilated or learned is no more apparent than when we now see the rise of a new fascist globalist organization, supported, as the Nazis were, fretted by international royalty, global industries, mass media, international politicians, like the Nazis were, and now indeed run by the son of one of Hitler's great supporters and industrialists, actively advocating for mind control, forced medical treatment, along with restricted travel, and now the destruction of the food chain and energy production. A course that will lead to far more deaths that both the Nazis and communists combined have been able to manage in the past century. And yet I'm sure industry will find a way to survive. Again, we are about to pay the price for refusing to learn anything, for allowing the same people to do the same thing again. The First World War was sustained and spurred on by industrialists and bankers. The second fueled and funded by the same. And the price was that communists took over half of the planet. Mao's communist regime resulted in the deaths of between 70 to 100 million Chinese. Stalin, at least over 30 million Russians dead, and the deaths of a third of the Ukrainian population in 1932 starved by communists. With the implementation of communist dictatorships all over Eastern Europe for decades to come after the Second World War, the industrialists who had so bravely supported Hitler, hoping he would be the bulwark against the Russian communists, or did they understand Hitler's desire for war against the Russians? Did they fully think through the intent that he was going to eradicate all Russian communists by waging war on them? Did they understand and control, or had they lost control and Hitler went his own way and started a World War II? And even after the war was in full swing, they were protecting their interests economically, of course. Had the bankers and industrialists misunderstood, miscalculated the Western politicians such as FDR and Churchill's desire to appease Stalin and allow him to gobble up half of Europe without any intentions of relinquishing? And once they understood, they had helped spur on a war that could not be won against the Russians especially, they safeguarded their assets independently in order to rebuild afterwards, which indeed they did. Not many years after the Second World War, most of the German businesses were back in business. But at what cost? In the immediate aftermath of the war, Russians kidnapped millions of German girls, men, women, children, and brought them east for slave labor. An estimated 2 million young girls and women in Germany were raped by occupying soldiers. Not just the Russians, but also the French, especially colonial soldiers. But all Allied countries involved, America included, cannot shed the mass crime. In the month after the war ended, even female forced laborers found in camps after the surrender were mass raped by British soldiers, as were French civilians as the U.S. Army marched across the continent, too much complaining. The German civilians, too, were robbed of everything by individual soldiers or groups, or organized whole-scale by the Russians. In their zones of occupation, everything was removed to Russia. Several million more Germans were killed in the forced evictions of all former German lands to the east, such as East Prussia. And an untold number of German soldiers and civilians were unlawfully detained in open-air POW camps. Hundreds of thousands starved to death, or were utilized as slave labor in French mines or factories, or even tortured in special British camps with little oversight. And to cap it all off, British soldiers managed to steal $6 million worth of the German royalty's crown jewels. And a train full of gold and silver from Czechoslovakian banks, apprehended by the U.S. troops, actually never made its way back to be registered, and all this disappeared as well. Sadly, from a human perspective, this is understandable. These young men had marched across the world, fought for their lives, and watched their friends die, and they enacted their measure of revenge or theft, something that was strangely enough accepted amongst many Germans. So this is not an indictment of the U.S. or Allied armies. And I hear you say, however, the Germans did this also, so what's the problem? The problem is that the victorious Allies always have claimed to have the moral high ground of especially not behaving like the nasty Germans. yet they committed practically the same crimes, sometimes even worse. And this should be pointed out in contemporary history. Instead of drawing opposites, draw parallels, and basic human nature under stressful conditions. The personal actions and responsibilities we each bear as human beings, the conscious decisions to do right, not to do wrong, that we need to teach in the light of these terrible events of war. Every side of the war stole, raped, killed. And one must feel sorry for the naive Judge Jackson, who wished for the Nuremberg trials to merely be an indictment of war itself and punish those guilty. How was he to know, sitting back in America, when he took on the job, that practically everybody was guilty? After the war, the Swiss claimed that they felt pressured to continue doing business with Germany, as they were practically surrounded with Italians on one side, the Germans on the other, and they feared being invaded at any moment. However, I find this quite impossible. Germany needed the Swiss banking system, its neutrality, in order to pay for and fund its war effort. And the Swiss knew this as well. And certainly there was no love lost between bankers and industrialists and Russian communists. So still, keeping aside, many of them were quite sympathetic to the German cause and chose to ignore the methods. It would be far more questionable as to their actions after the war, denying those survivors of the war access to their families or those who died's bank accounts for many decades to come. The motivation of international businessmen and bankers remained the same. It is to generate profit and gains, as the goal for most politicians is to be re-elected, something Churchill failed. 10 years after the war, Stalin was dead, FDR was dead. Churchill did one more term, but all the industries were back in their high seat. And the millions of dead, the soldiers, the civilians, who lay dead beneath the fields in the Middle East, in Europe, in South Pacific, well, dead they are. But despite that, the world saw an enormous raise in prosperity, technical development, and there's more people alive on Earth today than then, and the international businesses growing unhinged, and communist Russia is no more. However, having failed to learn from the lessons of this war and the reasons it started, began, and ran, have not been properly learned or implemented. We clearly see this now with the communists on the rise again, and new fascist organizations slowly encroaching on all of us. And it'll be interesting to see how globalized businesses will see us out of this pending crisis. Everybody acted the way they were raised or was indoctrinated to believe was right and proper. It is now an indictment of all of us, after all the suffering ended, that these lessons have not been taught to the next generation, that they might be raised with better values than we today have failed to raise and elect leaders who understand this and is capable of selflessly governing the individual nations. That is the truly tragedy of this war, and that we are now again faced with the next chapter of human horror, dictatorial and megalomaniacs by a new elite group of Übermenschen who believe the world belongs to them and not to you, the individual, who wish simply for a better life for your children. That is the true tragedy. But maybe we will all learn after the next time.
We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. To feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulty. Development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration. The need to maintain balance. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Behind me is Vannevar Bond's first test stand. Down the road is Deepness nuclear reactor. Over there is the Maginot Line and all its amazing forts. I'm visiting them all, and I'm bringing them to you. So I really appreciate you like, follow, and share what I'm doing, trying to document all these important historical locations. And if you feel like you want to watch more pictures or documents that are used for these, go to lostbattlefields.com. And if you feel like helping me out with my travels, because gasoline and travel and airfare is expensive, my PayPal is there, protectionserviceint.com. You are more than welcome, but you don't have to. I appreciate all your support and all your help, and I love seeing these locations, and I love bringing them to you.